The question was particularly important for the central banks of China, Japan, Taiwan, and South Korea. In the wake of the 2000 to 2001 stock market crash, private investors outside the United States had lost much of their interest in holding dollars, which added to the greenback's slow decline. However, beginning in a major way in 2002, Asian central banks stepped into the breach, buying U.S. Treasury debt on a grand scale, which worked to limit the dollar's erosion. The Congressional Budget Office, CBO, later calculated the purchase of U.S. assets by foreign governments at $113 billion in 2002, $280 billion in 2003, and $399 billion in 2004. Almost all of the purchases, said the CBO, came from Asia. In June 2004, the Financial Times reported a milestone. Demand for U.S. government bonds at foreign central banks has for the first time lifted overseas holdings to more than half the paper, Treasury debt, in circulation. As of that March, 50.6% of liquid Treasury bonds were in foreign hands, up from about 20% in 1995. The Atlanta Federal Reserve Bank in 2005 summed up that since 2001, Asian central banks' U.S. dollar reserves have increased by $1.2 trillion, roughly two-thirds of the cumulative U.S. current account deficit over that period. Two well-known international economists, Nouriel Roubini and Brad Setzer, have argued that the role of central banks in financing the U.S. budget deficit is much larger than some studies consider, since actual central bank purchases exceed recorded central bank purchases. Since 2000, all of the net new supply of treasuries has been purchased by non-residents, and about 80 to 90% of the new supply by foreign central banks. Politically, the implications were grave but enigmatic. The chugging of the U.S. economic locomotive, powered by the indebted American consumer, was really being financed by the central banks of the same countries selling John and Jane Smith their shoes, slacks, televisions, laptops, and Toyotas. The question was why, and answers were many. Officials of the Bush administration credited the ability of market forces to provide access to a globalized savings pool. However, cynics scoffed that because Asian central banks were losing money through purchasing short-term treasuries with negative real returns, their obvious motivation was to keep lucrative export markets open. Peter Marisi, a University of Maryland professor who earlier served as director of the Office of Economics of the U.S. International Trade Commission, went further, saying that China abuses global markets to obtain an objective: dominance. The importance of the American export market was real enough. Whereas U.S. manufacturing had been able to stage some recovery in the late 1980s with the help of a declining dollar, the underlying circumstances of 2004 to 2005 were much less yielding. More and more industries had been hollowed out by import penetration and by U.S. manufacturers' inability to compete with low-cost Asian production. By one calculation, foreign goods made up 38% of all durable goods purchases, including 54.5% of automobiles, 56% of computers and office equipment, 57% of semiconductors, 57% of all communications equipment, 71% of consumer electronics, 78% of apparel, and 99% of all footwear. Nor was this likely to change much. New investments in industries that manufactured tradable goods were ebbing in the United States because returns were better elsewhere. In 2004, U.S. investors and corporations got almost twice the return on their foreign direct investments, especially in Asia, that foreigners got on direct investments in the United States. The Dutch and British precedents were certainly relevant here. Imported petroleum, meanwhile, was riding a twin escalator. Its share of U.S. consumption was rising almost as fast as its cost per barrel. Economist Setzer, noting that outlays for oil imports had been some $100 billion in 2002, $130 billion in 2003, and $180 billion in 2004, predicted a 2005 oil import bill in the $232 billion range. Structural calcifications like these did not augur well for the U.S. current account deficit, which led serious economists back to the essential conundrum. What would happen to the dollar, and also to the willingness of Asian central banks to maintain and expand their dollar reserves to accommodate a further expansion of the U.S. current account deficit? Certain problems were already obvious. If interest rates in the United States rose to, say, 4-5% on 2-5-year Treasury notes, the federal government would face a considerably higher burden in servicing its huge debt, mostly short-term. Meanwhile, as Summers and others had noted, foreign central bank collaboration was not assured. I would suggest, the former Treasury Secretary had observed in 2004, that if one is seeking to draw lessons from the last 15 years of monetary experience, here is one that is very powerful. Fixed exchange rates with heavy intervention have enormous capacity to create an illusory sense of stability that could be shattered very quickly. That is the lesson of Britain in 1992, of Mexico in 1994, of emerging Asia in 1997, of Russia in 1998, and of Brazil in 1998. We can mark this down as a fourth danger zone of indebtedness. The national debt is the first, provided the reasonable additions that peg it in the $10 trillion to $15 trillion range. Household debt, deliberately ballooned by Washington policymakers, is the second. Financial sector indebtedness, the half-speculative nervous system that conjoins risky mortgages, shaky hedge funds, illiquid credit derivatives, and superbank overreach, is a third. The current account deficit belongs on the list, not least because of the unprecedented dimensions laid out by Summers and others. Not surprisingly, the previous leading world economic powers offer no precedent for the interplay of so many debt dimensions. I cannot help but think that the United States, like Spain in its day, has become something of a Judas economy for the average American, with Wall Street in the profitable bullion-handling role of early 17th century Seville, the Asian central banks as uncertain genuine financiers, and George W. Bush as the dull and prayerful Habsburg dynast. The caution about the United States using its global power to borrow, not to loan in the British manner, needs a bit more elaboration. Actually, the Kissinger deal with the Saudis and OPEC to recycle petrodollars in the 1970s and 1980s, discussed in Chapter 3, and the recent tacit arrangement with the East Asian central banks share a common design. Recycling by foreigners of U.S. payments for imports through channels that work to uphold the value of the U.S. currency. The possibility that both strings could soon run out as disillusionment with the United States sets in will be discussed in the concluding chapter. Not that any world currency winds down overnight. The Dutch guilder had a long process of being superseded by the British pound sterling, and some Britons understood by 1916 and 1917, never mind 1919, that the future might belong to the dollar. One historian has noted that the British Treasury warned the War Cabinet that by the end of 1916, the American executive and the American public will be in a financial position to dictate to this country. Several decades and two war-related global realignments later, that financial dependence was a fact. But before trying to add up the historical analogies, one more context requires pursuit. The likelihood of the United States being drawn into a war, terror-based, resource-based, or as some extension of the existing combats in Iraq and Afghanistan, akin to the expensive confrontations that helped to scuttle Spanish, Dutch, and British hegemony.